Okay, we're back together this morning. So this conference has, we began with plenary sessions, everybody together. And I think, I was thinking about this idea over the Shabbos, we ended up splitting up into our different niches and looking for different areas of interest. And then we come back on Sunday together and we do something. So, I mean, there's a philosophical idea of, you know, bringing that Achdus, that theme that we heard that, you know, over Shabbos that we have an opportunity to learn and experience, and then we come back, but we are, at the end of the day, one. Now, when we planned this session, let me give you the background to what this is, what the session is for and what it's intended to do and how our speakers are going to help develop this idea. Nobody would like to talk about this particular issue, and that is probably one of the most important topics. But importance is rated. I mean, some people are interested in Jewish history, some people are related into the separation of Siamese twins and the fundamental fascination. This topic that we're going to be discussing is, in many ways, bread and butter. And it's nothing to do with positions. The reality is, if you have parents that are aging, or if you're even thinking about yourself, you have to sort of think about these kind of issues. Now, granted, for people, this may be something which is way downstream, but like anything else in life, the question is how do you approach the end of life for people. The tension that's happening in the not only the medical establishment is the fact that there are two competing forces. And where we are dealing with is the competing force of managed care. Managed care on one hand is essentially promoting and pushing and advocating for a reduction in the end of life process and options, and essentially moving in that direction. Not only that, beginning on the horizon is the concept of physician-assisted suicide. This is already in Quebec. This is coming to Ontario soon. It's already in several states in the United States. So on one hand, you have that issue. On the other hand, there's been legislation that has been passed, for example, that there's some court cases in Canada in particular, and it's, I'm sure the same worldwide, where there was two very famous cases. There was one this past year at Sunnybrook Hospital, which is one of the teaching hospitals, so that's the Rizzulli, which went to the Rizzulli case, which went to the Supreme Court. It was a Muslim family who actually refused to take their family member off life support at a teaching hospital. And the teaching hospital insisted that they wanted, the resource issue, of course. And there was, of course, the case several years ago in Winnipeg, which you're all familiar with. So on one hand, we have to balance this out. The third element to this issue is, what do people do when they ask their rabbonim? Now, again, this is said with the most respect to the rabbonim in terms of the community. It's not possible to be an expert on everything. So we don't expect rabbonim on one hand to understand, let's say, for example, every part of agriculture. They have to ask experts in agriculture. You have to ask experts in. So the question becomes an end-of-life issues. On one hand, you can't run to a posek world across the world for something which is essentially ma'aseh b'chol yom, something which happens every single day. You need to develop some comfort. It's not something that you're separating, you know, twins. If you're separating Siamese twins, it's okay to say, look, you know what, it's outside of my scope. But people on ventilators, people on G-tubes, people on feeding tubes is something that happens every day. So the question becomes, if you're not equipped for this information, then it's just simply just to say, oh, sir, everything is going to be prohibited, and therefore you just continue this. And the question is this a service to the individual, to the patient, and is this even following halacha? I can think of no better person to address these issues, and we're going to do this in two parts. Rabbi Steinberg is going to lay the background for us in terms of the issues that we deal with at end-of-life issues with respect to some of those issues from a halachic perspective. And then after that, we have to get into with the concept of, which is the substitute decision maker. The substitute decision maker is all about knowing, oh, when an individual cannot speak for themselves, what do you do? And families battle this every day because you have, you know, one son who is Haredi, you have another son who is not Haredi, and whatever the family dynamics are going to be. And meanwhile, you know, Bobby, or grandma, is in the hospital. So decisions have to be made. So if you call the Rav, and the Rav just basically says, truth is, I really don't know, but I'll just say it's Osir, and we'll just continue, so that's one way. So you could just see where this goes. There are potential solutions in terms of advanced care directives. So for this, Professor Eliash is going to address the legal side, and then after that, we're going to have them come up as a panel, and I'll have the audience take care of the address, because I would imagine that this kind of setting is the right place to ask those questions. So without further ado, Rabbi Steinberg, if I could ask you to come and address the end-of-life issues.
Thank you. Good morning. It's the last session, and we talk about end of life, but I hope that it doesn't refer to the conferences. They can continue and going on. It's not end of life conferences. What I thought to do is relate to the substitute decision making from a halachic perspective by giving some overview on the major issues and the major opinions, because obviously there are differences of opinion in every halachic aspect, why not in end-of-life issues. So give you a little bit of a perspective of what it is, so that it will serve as an introduction to the specific topic of substitute decision-making, which is part of the whole gamut of end-of-life situations. So I think we referred to it already in some of the sessions before, but I think it's important to understand that halakhically there is a clear distinction accepted by most poskim. Again, I'm careful not to say that everyone agrees to everything that I'm saying, but that certainly is something that most poskim agree, that chayei sha'ah, which is temporal life, doesn't mean 1 hour, means a short period of time, as opposed to Chaye Olam, and again, Chaye Olam doesn't mean immortality and living forever. No one is going to live forever, but it means beyond Chaye Sha'ah, a certain period beyond Chaye Sha'ah. So, halachically, a Chaye Sha'ah person has, if you want to call it rights, that do not have people who have a potential of Chaye Olam. Certain things that are permissible for a Chaye Sha'ah are not permissible for Chaye Olam. Problem is that in the Talmud, where Chaye Sha'ah is discussed at length in the Masechta Avodah Zarah, and by the way, the key for the Chaye Sha'ah discussion in the Gemara is the story of the four Metzoroim, the four lepers who were outside the town of Jerusalem at the time that Ashur was fighting Israel, and as being Metzoraim, they were not allowed to dwell in the city. They were outside. There was a war going on, and they were hungry. There was no food. So they made a calculation. If we'll go into the city in order to get food, we may be killed because of the war. If we'll stay here, we'll die of hunger. If we'll go to the enemy, then it's a 50-50 chance either they'll kill us or they'll capture us, and at least we'll have food and survive. So this calculation, according to the Tanakh, was acceptable. They decided to go to the enemy. It turned out that there was a mess and they ran away. No one knew that the Ashurim left the battlefield. And then they came to the city and said, we won the war, HaKadosh Baruch Hu helped us, and there are no enemies around. Now, who were these four Metzoraim? The Gemara says that was Gehazi and his three sons. Gehazi is one of the people that has no chelek l'olam haba. The Gemara says that he was a Rosho, that he had no chelek l'olam haba. So Moshe Feinstein asks the Shaile, someone who has no chelek l'olam haba, from him you learn the halachas of Chai Yeshua, how to behave halachically, from someone who is not someone to be trustful. And his answer is that you don't learn from him halachic. You learn from him a behavior. People in such situation behave in a certain way. And since this behavior was sanctioned by Tanakh and Chazal, therefore, we adopt it as a halachic procedure. It's a very interesting concept, very unique. But be that it may, Chaye Sha'ah has a different setup of rules, And the problem is that it is not defined. What is, how much Chayei Sha'ah is Chayei Sha'ah? So most poskim rule that Chayei Sha'ah is equivalent time-wise, although not necessarily in the definition, to Treifa. And Treifa, we know that is defined as some, as an animal that cannot survive 12 months. So Chayei Sha'ah is a period of 12 months. If someone has a life expectancy of less than 12 months, he enters the definition of Chayei Sha'ah, and then all kinds of rules and regulations can be implemented, which cannot be for someone whose life expectancy is longer than 12 months. So that is an important aspect of when would a surrogate decision making enter into becoming a reality. It can enter only for such a patient that the expectation of his longevity is less than 12 months. And that is the story in Melachim Bet about the four Metzorayim and the Gemara in Amud Zohar that says that Hayesho has different set of rules. And again, this is the assumption, how long is the Hayesho? Now, just as a note on that, these poskim hold that Chayei Sha'ah is 12 months. The only one that I know that descends from this decision, by the way, Rav Moshe Feinstein brings this equation as well, and he talks about 12 months. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach told me numerous times that this is his position as well. The only one that I'm aware of that does not agree with it was Rav Eliashiv. He didn't accept this definition. He said, Hayesho is Hayesho and Treifa is Treifa. You can't equate between the two. But his problem was, so what is Hayesho? So he defined it as 3 months. I asked him for a source. He didn't give me. And to this day, I don't know where is this 3 months coming from. Why Hayesho should be defined as 3 months? But that is our Yashiv's position. Most or all other poskim hold different. Now there is a tshuva by Moshe Feinstein to his grandson that says that Hayesho is someone that is going, according to the opinion of the physician, to live less than 1 year because it is like Treifa. And he even adds that it's worse than Treifa, and therefore his answer to his grandson is that he asked him, how do you define exactly Hayesho and what is Hayoilo? And that was his answer, as we said earlier. Now, in order to understand what is a Hayesho different and where come certain decisions that can be permissible in a Hayesho that are not permissible in Hayoilo, we can look at it from an ethical halachic point of view. The value of life is, according to a minority opinion, an infinite absolute value. Now, once you say about a value in philosophy that it's of an infinite or absolute value, there are no exceptions to it. Because once there is even a slight exception to it, it becomes a relative term to this exception. So if it's absolute, it means that there are no exceptions to the rule. And if this minority opinion thinks that the value of life is infinite and absolute, then one is obligated to extend life by all means, in all conditions, for everyone, no matter how much suffering, no matter what the patient's wishes are. So if someone writes an advance directive and says, when I will be Hayesho by halakhic definition, or when my life expectancy would be less than 12 months, I don't want you to intubate me, it would be invalid. Because he can't shorten his life by any means, because every minute of life is of infinite value. And if you can extend the life even by one extra minute, according to this position, you must do it. So my wish not to do it is irrelevant from this halakhic standpoint. So if we would accept that the value of life is of infinite and absolute value, then we don't need to write any advance directives, and the answer would be everyone coming to the ER, no matter in what condition, we have to do everything we know to extend every minute of life, no matter what. That would be a position. And there are some rabbis, primarily the Tzitz Eliezer was of this opinion, and there are some other rabbis as well, but I think he is the one that leads this position. And according to him, there is no place for any advance directive, and you have to do everything possible to extend every life. But the majority opinion, which includes Moshe Feinstein and Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rav Vosner, and to a great extent even Rav Yashiv and many other poskim, Rav Avadi Yosef, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, all those held that indeed the value of life is extremely important, but it's not an absolute value. Now, if it's not an absolute value, and Chaye Shoah has a different din than Chaye Olot, then you can ask for certain things not to be done, or not to be, not to put into effect in specific condition, because it has other values that can oppose the value of life, which is important but not absolute. And that comes from a clear source. By the way, my personal humble opinion is that I really don't understand the position that halakhically the value of life is of infinite value. First of all, what we see today in Israel, soldiers are going in to fight with the knowledge that some of them will die. If the value of life is of infinite value, they have to bring etc. and say, I can't go to war because I may die, and I'm not allowed to do something which will cause me to die. And wars are sanctioned by the Torah and Halakha. So you see already an exception to the value of life, so how can you say it's an absolute value? And there are many other such examples, but the most important example relevant to our discussion is the story in the Gemara Ksubas, at the end of Ksubas, about the last day of Rabbi Yehuda Anosi. Rabbi Yehuda Anosi, the author of the Mishnah, had a disease called Samirta. We don't know exactly what it is. Some say it's gallstones or bladder stones. It was a disease that couldn't be cured in those days. Had excruciating pain. He suffered terribly. But his Talmidim prayed for his continuation to live. And their prayer, equivalent to a respirator, dialysis machine, a chemotherapy, whatever, their prayer was very powerful, and he continued to live. Rabbi Yehuda Anosi had a female servant, Amsei the Rebbe, that was famous in Shas as someone who knew a lot because, as we say today, a shiksa bamur, she saw, experienced a lot of things. And the Talmidim, the Gemara tells us that some of the Talmidim went to her to ask questions. And she knew to answer from what she experienced and heard from Rabbi Yehuda Anosi. So she was very close to him. And she felt that it is wrong that Rabbi Yehuda Anosi should continue living in such excruciating pain. But who is she compared to the Talmidim? The Talmidim are praying, that works. And what can she do? So the Gemara says that she went up to the roof, took a jar and threw it down. It made a noise. The Talmidim stopped for a minute because they were frightened for the minute. And in this second, Malach HaMoved penetrated their barrier and Rabbi Yehuda Anosi died. So that is the story. Now, if we translate this story to the philosophical, ethical, halachic dimensions, so we would say that the Talmidim of Rebbe held that life is of absolute value, and therefore, even though Rabbi Yehuda Anosi was suffering, he should continue to live. And Amsei the Rebbe thought that life is important, but there are exceptions. And this, to her mind, was an exception, and one should let Rabbi Yehuda Anosi die and not suffer. So if this is a machloikes, how is the halacha? Machloikes doesn't help us. How do we go? So interestingly, the Ram, somewhere entirely different in the Dori, that it has the Gemara in Sukkot, but the Ram in the Dori discusses this story and derives from here that halacha is like Amsei Derev, that if someone is suffering terribly and he is on the verge of dying, not only shouldn't you pray for his continuation to live, but you should pray for him to die. And as I said in several occasions, I did not yet encounter a shul where you make a mishaberach to someone to die. But that is, according to the Ram, what you should do. If you know someone that is dying, is chayesho, and suffering, you should pray for him to die and not continue to suffer. That is what the Ram says. Halachically, Halacha Lemaise, that ruling of the Ram has qualifications, who is allowed to pray, and what type of prayer, and so on. We won't go into it, I'm talking just about the principle. So the principle is that life is not of infinite value, it is very important, but not of infinite value, and in extreme cases, certainly we don't have to do something to extend life, we may even do certain things which cause deaths to come a little sooner. So that is the source from the Gemara and the Rav. Now there's an interesting letter in Karyana de Gerta by the Stipler, who writes that he heard when he was a child that one has to prolong the life of a sick patient even if it is Chayesha only. One should do everything to prolong his life. That is what he heard when he was a child. And he said, Velo yadati im zeu mibalsamcha. I don't know if what I heard comes from someone who is authoritative and knows what he's talking about. Why? Because the Einai, I think that is wrong. And he brings the Shulchan Aruch, which we'll see in a minute, that says that in certain occasions, you should not do acts that will extend the suffering of a dying patient. And he concludes that if it is only Chayesho, and you can't really save it, it is as if he is already a Goyses, and in a Goyses, you don't touch him, you don't treat him, you let him die. So that is the Stipler's understanding from the souls in Yodea, which is based on the Gemara in Ksubas and the Ram in the Dorim that I just showed you. And the same holds true for Moshe Feinstein, which went one step further. Moshe Feinstein says that if someone has no cure to his disease, and what we can do is only prolong a short period of time, if we talk about Hayesho, if we talk about someone who is going to die of disease, and he is suffering, he has Yisurim, he says also, and he quotes it twice, you are not only don't you have to do it, but actually you are forbidden from extending his life and extending his suffering. That was said in several occasions as in several tshuvas of Moshe Feinstein. I remember one discussing it with the Shlomzamenoyevah, who said that he agrees with the principle that comes out from here, that in a Chayesho suffering person, you don't have an obligation to prolong life, but he thought that death is going a little too far to say that there is a prohibition to prolong life, because life is precious. You can't say that it's prohibited. You can say that you don't have a chiyuv, you don't have an obligation. But he thought that went a little too far, but clearly, according to Rav Moshe, adding suffering in a situation which you can't cure and the person is going to die is forbidden. Now, that comes from a concept which is called Meisir Hamonea, or removing an impediment, and it comes primarily from Sefer Chassidim, which interprets the pasuk in Kohelet, the Et Lamut. You know, in Kohelet there are different times, so one of them is Et Lichyot, ve Et Lamut. says the Sefer Hasidim, et lamur, why do you have to say it? We know that there is a time that people die. What's the et lamur? The et lamur is that when a person is at the verge of dying, you don't pray for him to live longer. That is the et lamur. You helping the et lamur. Based on that, the Moan Shulchanor fastens that it is forbidden to do an act that hastens that, but it is permissible to remove an impediment that prevents a person from dying. The example that is famous is, they believed in those days that if there is noise, the neshama can't depart the body. So if someone is lying in bed dying, and there's outside a chopper that makes a lot of noise by chopping wood, you are allowed to tell the chopper to stop the noise so that the person can die. Now, that has a double-edged interpretation. On the one hand, you are allowed to stop the noise, but according to the Tzitzel Yehuda, for instance, if you have to do everything to extend every life, even in this condition, not only should you be forbidden to stop it, actually you have to hire more wood choppers because maybe he'll get tired for a minute and the person will die. So you have to do everything that he shouldn't die. So not only don't you have to hire more wood choppers at a time, but you can stop the wood chopper from making noise. And there are other similar examples that you are allowed to remove the impediment. Now, if we go to modern terminology, and modern terminology discusses primarily the principle of autonomy, which many of the laws in Western societies are based on. So, for instance, if someone comes in Holland or in Belgium and says, I have a terminal illness, I am suffering, I don't want to live anymore, but I know that I won't die now from the disease, even if you don't do anything, I'll die in 6 months. I want to die now, so therefore I want you to kill me now, because I want to die now. According to those laws, the physician is killing the patient. That is called, in a nice language, euthanasia. Euthanasia means taking a gun and killing the patient. In hospitals we don't use guns, but we have substitutes to guns, and they killing patients. That is based on the notion of autonomy. So in those countries, if someone writes a living will or an advance directive saying, if I will be at the end of my life and I'll be suffering, I don't want 1 minute to live in this condition, then they'll kill him. That is the notion of autonomy. That would be correct if autonomy is an absolute value. But I think that everyone agrees, or at least ought to agree, that autonomy may be important, but certainly not absolute. Because then, why do these countries allow the autonomous wish to kill a patient, and they don't allow an autonomous wish to kill someone who is not a patient? Let's say I come, I am healthy, but I'm sick and tired of my life, and I want to die. So they say, no, I can't do it. Why can't you do it? If autonomy is an absolute value, what do you care if there is a reason that you agree with or you don't agree with? That's my wish. So autonomy is limited by all countries at certain stages. But they went so far to say that autonomy does apply if we're talking about a dying, suffering patient. Now, does autonomy apply at all from a halachic point of view? Can one say, I wish to do this or not to do that, and we will follow it? So that is where the difference between Hayesher and Hayolom comes into play. If someone has if someone is going to live more than 12 months, even if he asks not to be treated so that he will die, we don't allow it, we don't follow it. We even enforce the treatment to prolong his life, as long as the treatment is effective and really saves life. So we don't have the autonomy for Chaye Olam to shorten life. But we do have the autonomy in Hayeshot. If someone anyway is going to die within 12 months, no matter what we'll do, and he doesn't want a certain treatment, which means that he'll die a little sooner than he would die if we would apply this treatment, he is allowed to elect not to be treated. And that autonomous wish is only if it is Hayeshot. And that is what Moshe Feinstein writes in several occasions, that there is some values on this life, although usually we say that we don't own our body, and therefore why should our autonomous wish to ruin our body be accepted? He says there is some degree of ownership of the body when it is Hayeshot. And he goes at length to explain how this works. And he gives the example, the ones that wrote the last statement of Moshe wrote the Hebrew word the chole sartan, but in parentheses, cancer. Because Moshe spoke in the language of the country, I don't know that he knew what sartan is, that's the Hebrew word. So he spoke about cancer, but we know it's sartan. If someone has cancer that he can't be cured, but it can be prolonged for a few months only, and in those times he will have pain and suffering, you can tell him that we can prolong, but if it doesn't work, we don't have to treat it. And the same holds true with Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's position. That's a famous short tshuva that he writes, that if someone wants to live longer with pain and suffering, obviously it is acceptable and it's nice, but there is no obligation to do it, and we can allow someone not to prolong his life in a Hayeshot with suffering. Now, in Israel, we enacted a law covering these issues. It's an extensive law. I think one of the conferences I told about this law. I had the privilege to be the head of the committee that proposed the law. It was a huge committee, 59 members. Now imagine three Jews speaking about the weather. You get probably six opinions. And here you have 59 of them talking about end of life with so many problematic issues. So you can imagine how the sessions went on. It took 2 years to finish this proposal, but we reached a consensus. And the consensus actually is a law in legal, ethical terms, which are exactly the position of Moshe Feinstein and Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. I wasn't allowed to say that it goes according to Shlomo Zalman, because then it wouldn't be accepted, but using different terms and saying the same was accepted, and that is now the law in Israel based on those assumptions. Now, I think it's important to see a few of the aspects of the law to understand how to write a living will or advance directive by halachic criteria according to those who are allowed to do it. Again, if we go according to those who say that life is of infinite value, then nothing can be written. Then you have to do everything. But assuming that you are allowed to refuse certain treatments, what are you allowed to refuse, and what aren't you allowed to refuse, even if we accept that you don't have the obligation to prolong life? And that is very important. The details are very important. A little bit complicated, I won't go into each and every detail, but just to give you a concept. So, people approaching end of life can be subdivided from an autonomous perspective into three major categories. Some who are currently competent, meaning someone has 6, 7, 8 months to live, and he's still competent. Most of us won't be in this situation. The majority of dying people at this stage are either demented or comatose or psychotic or whatever, and they are not competent, but there is a minority that is competent. Mostly have been competent during their lifetime, But in the final stage, they become incompetent, which is the majority of people, and they can be subdivided into those who have an advanced directive and those who don't have an advanced directive. So each and everyone in this room, assuming that all of you are competent at the moment, it's an assumption, I don't know, so you can now write an advanced directive, what you would want to be done with you when you will be a dying patient and incompetent. And then that will be how we will act upon. But if you don't do it, and you reach the stage of Hayesho and you are incompetent, we don't know what you want at real time. And then there is a subgroup of people who are never competent. I treat pediatric cases who are dying. They are children who have diseases and they die as children, even as infants. So they were never competent. So there's nothing that we can assume what they would have wanted because they were never competent. In fact, there are adults who are dying, who were all their lives severely mentally retarded, and we can't discern what would have been their wishes. So that is a separate category. Now the law in Israel takes care of all these categories. What do you do in end of life with each of these categories? So I want to talk only on one category, the category of currently incompetent, but previously competent. So what you can do is write an advanced medical directive or appoint a surrogate or a proxy and then follow what it says. Now remember or pay attention to it that the surrogate or the proxy is appointed by the person himself while he is competent. We are not talking about someone who becomes incompetent and the court appoints a proxy. That is almost irrelevant because when he comes into scene, he knows the same as I know. He does no more because at the moment now, when he is being appointed by the court, the person is already incompetent. So we are talking about someone who is competent and himself appoints a surrogate. Now, if those are missing, you can consider a close person statement. I won't go into it. It's an Israeli patent of how to relate to people who don't have advanced directives. In most countries, and in Israel up to this law, you would ask the next of kin, what does he think to do with his mother, son, husband, or whatever. We felt that this is not good enough representing the autonomy of the patient, because imagine two brothers who fought all their lives, are separated for many years. One lives in California and one lives in Yerushalayim. The one in Yerushalayim has a big villa and he's dying. Yeah. So the next of kin, his brother, that hated him all his life, wants to get this opportunity and inherit the villa. So he comes and says, don't treat him, let him die. Does this really represent the best interest of this patient because his next of kin told us that this is what he thinks should be done? Not always. And certainly, with the example that Dr. Friedman gave, if the next of kin are divided, one is Haredi, one is Kippah Sugah, one is atheist, and one is converted, and whatever, and who do you follow? Who is the next of kin that will make the decision? So we define a different person. I won't go into. So now, the advanced medical directive in Israel, based on the law that I told you, is legally binding. A physician cannot say, well, that is what he said then, I think today differently, and I disregard it. He can't do it. It's legally binding. There is a form that is attached to the law which says what the patient wants, what the person, while he was healthy, wants or doesn't want, and it is limited to what halakhically he is allowed to request. Again, this wasn't said in so many words, but it was formulated in back of mind, taking this into account, in order to fill out the Israeli medical advance directive, you need a medical advice, but not a legal advice. It's not done by a lawyer, it's done with the advice of a physician or a nurse. And importantly, and I think uniquely for Israel, one has to renew it every 5 years. Statistics show that at least 30% of people who write at some point in their lives an advance directive change their minds. So if someone wrote an advance directive 20 years ago and now he is dying, it doesn't mean that what he wrote then, he indeed wants it today. So it was a difficult decision to find the right timing that would be practical on the one hand and representative on the other hand. So we decided 5 years, so every 5 years it has to be renewed. And we have a national database. Yeah?
So if they don't renew it in 5 years?
No, it's not invalidated, but it is not as binding as if it would have been renewed. In other words, it is a test of wishes. We know that these were his wishes, but are we sure that he wants it today? So if circumstances are such that we can assume that he didn't mean this situation, we can overrule it. Whereas if it was renewed in the 5 years, that would be binding. That's the difference. Now the database is important for two aspects. One is, if you want someone to renew every 5 years, the chances that someone will remember every 5 years to renew it are zero. So if you have the database and you send in your advance directive, the database will send you a reminder every 5 years that you have to relate to your advance directive, like we do with a license, right? With a driver license. We don't remember when to renew it, but the authorities send us a reminder and we know that we need to renew it. And secondly, let's assume that someone lives in Tel Aviv and he has an advance directive and he went for a trip to Tzfat and he was hit by a car and now he's comatose in Tzfat. People there don't know him. He not necessarily is carrying with him the advance directive. How would the ER in Tzfat know if he has an advance directive and what it says? So if there is a database that is connected with all the hospitals in Israel, so everyone that comes into any ER can get in touch right away with the database and then find out whether this person has an advance directive and what it says. So I think that is a very important innovation that I think countries should adopt it as well. Okay, so now what can we ask in an advance directive? So actually the treatments are subdivided into three categories. One is to do everything. Everything I put in parentheses, because obviously no one will do a heart transplant to someone who's dying in 2 weeks in order for him to live 3 weeks. That obviously is not something that can be done. But everything means put him on a respirator, CPR, dialysis, whatever is a treatment, even if it will extend life by a few hours or a few days. That is one option. That obviously is based on the philosophical assumption that the value of life is of absolute value. So 1 minute is as worthy as 70 years. There's no difference between them. The other end of it is active euthanasia, which means I write in my advance directive when I will be in this stage dying, suffering, kill me right away. So that is based on the concept that autonomy is the overriding principle and I respect your autonomy. That's what you want. That's what I'm doing. So a minority position amongst the poskim would go according to the first option. No one goes by the second option. And the majority goes by the third option, which is a balance between life and autonomy, or quality of life, which means that in certain instances, with certain treatments, we will follow the autonomous wishes, and other treatments, despite the fact that there are autonomous wishes, we will not give the patient what he wants. So there are several ways to look at it. One is called omission or withholding versus commission or withdrawing. So let's say someone who is on a respirator, let's take someone who is in respiratory failure and he is not yet on a respirator, he can request not to put him on a respirator when time comes. That is called withholding treatment. Or someone is already on a respirator and he requests to remove him from the respirator because he's suffering and he doesn't want to continue living. That would be an act of withdrawal because he's already there and I'm doing an act that takes him away. We in Israeli law, based on Shlomo Zalman's definition, make a distinction between a continuous treatment and a cyclic treatment. A continuous treatment is a respirator. A respirator, you put one on a respirator, it has to go on. If you stop it, he'll die if he's respirator dependent. Whereas dialysis is a cyclic treatment. By the nature of the treatment, you hook up a patient to a dialysis machine for 4 hours on Sunday, you take him off, not as a withdrawing process, but that's how you treat dialysis, and on Tuesday he comes back and he gets another cycle. So these are separate units of treatment, each in time and in nature. If you think about it, almost all treatments in end of life are cyclic. Chemotherapy you give once in 10 days or once in 2 weeks or whatever. Antibiotics you give periodically. Insulin you give periodically. Dialysis you give periodically. So these are cyclic treatments. The only two examples that are continuous treatments are a respirator and a pacemaker. If someone has a pacemaker and he's dependent on the pacemaker works continuously, if you stop the pacemaker, he will die. You can't give him periodically. There are, however, pacemakers that work on demand, that they are silent, and when an arrhythmia occurs, they kick in, and that's a relatively new shayle. The same with the defibrillator that is implanted so that when there is an arrest, the defibrillator kicks in, but in between it doesn't. And relatively newly asked China is, are you allowed to remove the silent pacemaker or the defibrillator at a point that they are not working so that when time comes that it should kick in, it won't kick in? Is it a form of withdrawal because it's already in the body, or is it a form of withholding because it's silent and you don't stop anything, it will only happen later? So, as in most instances, there's a machlokes on that as well. Rabbi Yashin holds that you're not allowed to remove it even if it's silent. The Rosh Hashanah, Zalman Nechemia, and others that I discussed just recently with them, they feel that that is called a withholding, and you're allowed to remove it or at least stop it. You don't need to take it out physically, you just reprogram it that it shouldn't kick in, and they feel that that would be permissible. Now, an important distinction, again, based on Shlomo Zalman's position, is treatment pertaining to the fatal condition versus treatment pertaining to life. So if someone has cancer and is going to die of cancer, the treatment for him is chemotherapy. The treatment for him is a respirator because he stops breathing. We, healthy people, don't need this treatment. So that is a treatment pertaining to the fatal condition. That is something that we can respect the autonomous wish of a dying patient in Chai Yeshua to withhold it. But food and fluid or regular antibiotics that everyone needs and takes it whether he's dying or not, it's unrelated to the fact that he's dying. It's related to the fact that he's still alive. That has to be provided even if the patient doesn't work. So these are important distinctions that secular ethics and secular laws don't accept these distinctions. So these three distinctions are unique to halakhic thinking, which are totally unacceptable by secular thinking, And the Israeli law accepted it as an ethical position, but really as a halakhic position.
So here are types of treatment. The green one are those pertaining to the fatal condition, which can be withheld. And the blue ones are those that are part of a regular routine treatment, whether you are dying or not dying. These are things that are done for live people because they are alive and they cannot be even withheld. So in summary, active euthanasia is absolutely forbidden. Physician-assisted suicide is absolutely forbidden. By the way, now there is a new notion to correct the law that I described to you and to allow physician-assisted suicide in Israel. It passed already the first level. I hope it will be stopped at the next level. And withdrawal of continuous treatment is also forbidden. On the other hand, it is permissible to withdraw psychic treatment, which actually, halakhically, is not a withdrawal, but a withholding process, and it's allowed to withhold any treatment as long as it wasn't started, except for food, fluid, and those types of treatments. So here is a letter written by the most renowned Boskim, of Yashir, from Zanoeva, of Voltner, and of Nissim Karelis, that ruled that routine treatments, including food and routine treatments, must be given to anyone, even if he's dying. And it is according to what senior physicians told those rabbis. I had the privilege to be one of the three physicians that consulted on this issue. And the treatments that have to be given, even if the patient refuses, are those that we discussed. It doesn't say here that other treatments can be withheld, but obviously it's derived from the positive. What you have to do is this, so it's understood that others you don't have to do. That was, and by the way, just as an anecdote, writing this few lines, I mean, how many lines are there of this psak? There was a huge machloikis, inner machloikis between them, A, who will be the first, the second, the third, and the fourth to sign. There was a big issue, and it went from one to the other, and finally this was decided. And the question was whether the list...
Yerushalayim before the next.
Yeah. The second, but by the way, the machloikis here between Rabbi Yashiv of Shomzan Loerbach was who would be the second one. Neither of them wanted to be the first. There was an ANOVA here. So Shozaman insisted that he will not be the first, so Rabbi Yashiv agreed to be the first. Anyway, the other issue was, this list is the most important part of the psak. The principle is beforehand. So why not sign after this? I mean, that's part of the psak. And Avshalom Zalman said, I want to sign here because I want to be responsible also for the list. That is part of the psak. And Avel Yashin refused because he said, this is a medical decision. We are not physicians. We are rabbis. We are saying the principle. Here are physicians that we agree with their assessment that that should be, but our signature should be on the psak and not on the medical details. So these, just as an anecdote to show you how things work. So in summary, if the person is a dying person, I don't want to go into the 6 months issue, halakhically it's 12 months, but as you know, no physician can prognosticate 12 months, that's an impossibility, so therefore in the law, we limit it to 6 months, which this can be done in certain diseases, by prognostication, but halakhically, in principle, it can be 12 months. The patient has to be suffering, and you are allowed to withdraw treatment pertaining to the dying patient, provided they are psychic. And then, either the person himself, if he's still competent, can ask to withhold these types of treatment. If he is incompetent, he can either have an advanced medical directive or appoint a surrogate or a close person or a rabbinic decision can come into play and decide what to treat and what not to treat. So this is the majority opinion on how to write an advanced medical directive. I assume that the panel will discuss the details of some examples of advanced directives, if they really follow these principles or not. And those who hold that you have to do everything don't need advanced directive, obviously. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Steinberg. What we're going to do now is we're going to move now to actually explore a little bit of what these advanced directives are. We've heard the term proxy, the healthcare proxy. We've also heard some of the issues around the advanced directives. For those of you living in Toronto, so first of all, before Toronto, everybody knows that if you go on the website and you can go and find either an RCA. There's multiple of these directives that are found. That the RCA has one. I believe the OU has one. The interesting thing that came out this past winter was Toronto felt that they wanted to get in this act as well. So Toronto convened a group of individuals who I don't know who the authors are, to be honest with you. I have my suspicion, and based on the lecture we just heard, we can infer, but nonetheless, this was circulated just to the people in Toronto through the Bayit, which is a shul. It's essentially a mainstream congregation. It's a young Israel type of a shul. And the rabbi sent it out to the congregation and said it would be something that you should actually read and sign. Anyway, the rabbi's not here, and I'm not here to create any controversy. The point is that this is how this was born. So in your handout, on page 132, for those of you that are from Ontario, you will see a document there that is directed actually specifically to the group in Ontario. Otherwise, you could look at the one that's from the RCA, and that would be fine. There are some very interesting differences between the different ones. And for this, we've asked Professor Eliash, who is an associate. He is the associate dean at Carmel University at the law school, and I've asked him to address this particular issue. After which, Rabbi Steinberg and Professor Eliash will hold the panel, and we will have some questions relating to some individual cases that you may have in mind. Professor Eliash.
May I speak without my? Yeah. I think everyone hear me. Okay. In my school, I've never used mic because I told them God blessed me with strong voice. And I'm always win in any debate because my voice is open. Okay, I think Professor Steinberg told us whatever we need almost. So I will do only some remarks, and I don't think you will complain because the time is short. First remark, because I was requested to point out the legal aspects of America and Canada. I must admit that till last week, I was not familiar with the Canadian law. American law, okay, everyone knows. But now, I'm an expert. Okay, first remark is, in America and in Canada, both are actually federated. Means you have a federal law, and you have a mostly, this subject is, if I will speak about Canada, province law or state law. So in America you have 50 laws about dying, natural dying, dignity, whatever it's called. And in Canada, I don't remember, I think six or seven, how many provinces, I don't remember. seven? No, one province. became a lively subject. Some quote, it's a most lively subject in law, right to that. And it's, say, living will and the proxy, elsewhere proxy. This is two types of advanced medical and the living will I will say something about the advantages and the disadvantages of these two types of directive, advanced directive. Living will, what is good in living will, you can write exactly what do you wish. No mistake. You can write it whatever you like, when you are competent, of course, and this everyone has to fulfill your wishes. This is the advantage. The disadvantage are that living wills is writing now, is written now, and as one professor said, and this is very important thing, what seems to a young guy of, let's say, 30, a life that doesn't work. I remember a case, a young soldier, they cut his foot, he didn't want to live. 18 years old. How can I live without a foot? He divorced 3 times later. So it's worth to life, to live. And what seems to young guy and was life for a guy 8 years old, he said, at least I can eat and test something, it's also good. Even I'm paralyzed and so on and so on. So in willing will in life will, you cannot imagine, or you can imagine, but you don't imagine right. This is one. The second is that medical pathology is improved. We know, everyone knows, that coma is the end of the life. You cannot raise coma. But who knows? 10 years, 50 years, 30 years, the technology will change. And as Professor Steinberg said, most of the people, they don't change. They don't think about every time to change it. I saw a nice episode in Seinfeld, that Kramer, one knows him, he made a living will, and he wrote this and this and such, if you are blind, if you are blessed, and all of a sudden he watched the television and he saw a woman who wake up from a coma, so he ran away to change his living will. These are two disadvantages. The proxy advantage is that you appoint someone that you rely on. Generally, someone from the family. Generally, younger than you, naturally. The kids, boys, girls, wives, sometimes. Excuse me. They live longer. And he or she will decide on the matter when it comes. The disadvantage, that any agent, any proxy, does not fulfill the entire vision that you would decide on this time. But of course, we have the third way of combination. You can live a living will with your wishes, and you can say, I appointed a proxy, elsewhere a proxy, who follow my wishes, let's say, amended by his consideration, something, medical development or something else. A living will, I can bring you a sample, because it's very short, it's very simple, living will. It's, for instance, if this is a standard living will, of course, if you are coming to a lawyer, it will be much, much longer because it charged by time. He cannot give you two, three lines and charge you for $2,000. No. And but the standard is, if I will suffer an irrecoverable, irreversible illness, disease, or condition, and my attending physician determined that my condition is terminal, this is what you kind of say, I direct that life-sustaining measure that would serve only to prolong my dying be withheld or discontinued. This is a little bit very simple. And it speaks about one situation. Of course, you can write 20 situations. And I read that in America, in 2007, 41% of the population had living will. And it became very popular after President Obama said he and Michelle, they have living will. So this is what I read, and I believe it's right. In 2007, I think many more. Most of states, and Ontario also, Manitoba, adapted the healthcare proxy system. And this is also very, very simple. I must tell you, now as a Jewish law lecturer, the healthcare proxy based on agency, the law of agency, shlichut, it's a simple shaliach to do on behalf of me. And I can do whatever I like, whatever I like, I can appoint an agent, Shlucho Shel Adam Kemoto. And I must tell you, the first legal system in the world that recognized and actually created this idea that if my agent does something now, it's like I did it in the same time. Aish mekadesh po mishmucho, if the shaliach is mekadesh, now I am married. And I can be married according to Jewish law without seeing, my wife, and she will not see me. And sometimes there can be a widow or without seeing each other. This is the basis of shlichut. So, as a proxy, is a simple shaliach, and a shaliach, it's very easy in all systems of law to appoint one. And you can appoint and you can revoke, and the proxy stand up and say, I, so and so, hereby appoint him or her as my health care agent. I'm reading from the New York State standard proxy, but it's the same all for a care agent to make any and all health care decision for me, except to the extent that I state otherwise. Okay. This proxy shall take effect only when and I and if I become unable to make my own health care decision. This is a health care proxy appointment. You need two witnesses, not a colleague, not a relative, some limitations, and that's all. And you can appoint. And generally, in all the standard firms, are alternate proxy, because maybe you die, or not one, or not B, and so on. This is the proxy, and this is the living will. Now, my last remark will refer, according to Lazar's request, to the two forms that you have here in the RCA form and the Toronto's form, the Alatic form. What they did both, they adapted the proxy, the healthcare proxy conception. And this is right, and this is also much easier for everyone. What they added to the standard proxy, according to Canadian law, family law, and American law, it's the same principle. They added what the general law calls the values of this person. It's a declaration, first of all, I'm Jewish, and I'm an Orthodox Jew, and I want that direction to follow the Jewish law and so on. And this is the most practical thing. They appointed in the proxy a rabbi. Name, with a cell phone, with his address, an alternate rabbi, and so on. And say that my proxy has to take advice that she follows the instructions of the rabbi, because this is the way that I lived all my life, and I would like to say. And I wouldn't talk about it. Each of these firms, both, are talking also about postmodern, because proxy and so on. But let's talk about it. So, the difference between the two, first of all, I would say what is the main problem that I see. It's not a legal problem, it's a practical problem. Every one of us, as Professor Feinberg said, we say to choose the opinions and so on and so forth. If you appoint a proxy, generally, a son, two sons, whatever. It's pretty easy. Not so common, pretty easy. If you appoint a rabbi, well, say, document is signed by one, by a person, a woman, man. But actually, we all know, it's the entire family sitting together, who will be the rabbi. And if you think it will be decided in one day, you are made. And everyone has this rabbi. This rabbi is Machmir, this rabbi, Orthodox rabbi, of course. This rabbi is Maker, this rabbi, I don't rely on him, and that he will not be, he's always in Israel, in California, you will not find him when you need him. It's very, very complicated. If they would ask me what to do, I would adopt this short paragraph that Professor Steinberg showed us of four actually the greatest rabbis of living with us, but from Salman, Yoshua, and they wanted a very short synthesis. This is a practical problem of both of them. The difference between the American and the Canadian, Ontario, Toronto, and RCA is, I don't want to insult Toronto, I said yesterday, I love Toronto, for people and so on, so. But the RCA forum is much simpler. And as simple as you can is better. When you are going to convince one of the corporations to sign, do it short and simple. No, don't complicate. And the RCA forum said, okay, you appoint a rabbi, the proxy has to take advice to follow the rabbi's instructions and so on. So. They, Toronto is much more pessimistic. First of all, it's the same. If the rabbi is if both of them cannot, so there is an institution. I don't know how choice institution. Yeah, it's really an institution, I don't know, Rabbinical Council of Canada, if there is something like this. And if not, then a list of, I think, 2 pages, if you look, that I will read only the first paragraph and I will finish. They say something like this. My wishes, this is the headline, of the same proxy appointment. Medical orders for life-sustaining treatment. I wish to always receive all possible life-sustaining health care to sustain my life for as long as possible. And this is a rule. This is a rule. For further clarify, I direct that this wish of mine be carried out to treat all medical conditions unless my rabbinic advisor rules that it is contradiction under Jewish law. And then come a list of paragraphs with many situations. And the rule is, it's not allowed unless. And the RCA forum is much more simple to say, take advice, if it's following the Jewish law, is okay. I think the only words that I can finish speaking about dying about this is, in Yiddish we say, well, I think my Yiddish is okay. No, it's like my English. Thank you. I can take 2 seats, it's okay, because I am fat. But I'm not part of these 2. Okay.
Floor now to questions. I just want to make a point. What Professor Elliott was reading was page 138. That's in the book there. And the comment before any of the questions will be the question in this document were the authors alluding to the case that happened at Sunnybrook Hospital in Toronto, where the Muslim family was trying to get their family member prolonging life support? And the courts and the doctors were against it. This came out within a month of that case going to court. So that might be the backdrop to that. I will open up the floor. Jeff.
I guess I'm an oncologist, so being in a position where I have patients who are in the life is not uncommon.
I can't give a difference.
I'm an oncologist.
to be in a position where cutting patients at the end of life is uncommon and where treatment may very well be futile is not uncommon. I'm actually a little disturbed by the document I see from Toronto where I practice that this would be presented to. Unlike other jurisdictions where your care may be determined by whether you have insurance or can pay for the treatment, everybody has access to the same treatment. Now, we do run into resource implications. I'll give you two classic examples. I've had patients who are in need of an ICU in theory, and in the whole greater Toronto area, there are no ICU beds except for one. There's a choice between my patient, who's now exhausted 5 lines of chemotherapy and has failed, is going to die, or a 20-year-old accident victim who may survive. I have other situations as we run into blood shortages in Ontario. Toronto particularly is not very good at donating blood, and each time of year, such as now or before Christmas, we have to play God and decide who gets blood and who doesn't, and they're so available. What do I do when someone hands me this? When I put it in that situation, I'm handed this by a person, a family member, for a patient who I cannot do anything with, who I know is going to die within the next few hours of the day. And how can I defend this type of agreement when I have a 20-year-old, perhaps even non-Jewish, who will survive if they go to that last ICU bed to the city? This leaves me in a very difficult and uncomfortable situation. I really have a lot of difficulty because, as I said, I will not tell a rabbi how to custom, but I'd sure be upset if your rabbi tells me how to manage something medical.
I'll tell you what we solved in the Israeli law, and I think, again, according to Allah, but I want to preface it by one word that you use that I think we have to be careful with, and that's futile treatment. I don't think that we talk the same language when we say futile treatment. I don't know if you know the origin of the word futile. Futile comes from the Greek futulus, which is a myth of someone who was punished by the gods to take a basket full of holes at the bottom of a mountain, fill it with water, go up the mountain, and bring the water up there. So obviously, because it's seeping through, he'll never do it, and he has to do it all his life, going up and down. Futile treatment in medical terminology is only one situation, where the physiological outcome of the treatment is zero. In other words, if you have a corpse and you do a CPR on him, that is futile. But if you have a living person that has 5 days to live and you do a CPR on him and he lives 6 days, that is not futile. That is your definition of the worth of life, but it achieved the purpose. If for this person to live one more day is important, for instance, on the 6th day, there will be a bar mitzvah of his grandchild and he wants to see it. It's very important for him. You as a physician don't know it. And why should you call it futile? So I think it's a misnomer and I don't think it should be used because it covers up for either philosophical outlooks or economic outlooks, which I'll come to the important question that you asked. But I think if you look at the literature of futility, there was once an article in the Lancet, the futility of the futile term, which means that really it's a futile term to use futility in this sense. So there's nothing that can achieve any physiological purpose that is futile in a sense that by saying futile, you allow not to give it. You can be perfectly right not to treat because not worth living, because it takes up a bed, because it causes suffering. You have to spell out what you mean by just the euphemism, futility. Because for people listening to the physician saying it's a futile treatment, they think it's a medical term which is fast and strong, and I think, personally, it's a mistake. But that's just a comment. The issue is as follows. If you have every availability to treat a patient, and you think that philosophically it's wrong to prolong his life, that is one scenario. The second scenario is you think it's right to prolong his life, but you don't have the resources to do it. So then you come to a different, totally different issue, and that is prioritization. And it has nothing to do with futility or dying. You have a car accident with 20 injured people. Who do you treat first? Most of them can survive, but you can't give the treatment to all of them. So there is a system of prioritization. And everyone agrees, including Abel Yashiv and including Tzitz Eliezer, that if you have an ICU bed, and it's the only bed available, and you have someone who is Chaye Shor and someone who is Chaye Oilom takes precedence. You take the person with Chaye Shor, you take him out of the ICU, and you replace him with someone who has a chance to live. It has nothing to do with the principle that if the patient wants to be treated, you ought to treat him. So in the Israeli law, we added a paragraph that says the following. A patient, usually the living wills or the proxies are to limit treatments, right? Because the default is that you treat. You don't want to be treated, you have to say. But there are people who want to be treated, despite best medical advice, then it doesn't make sense. Because whatever the physician thinks is sensible or not, right? So let's say someone says, I want to do everything possible because I hold the Tzitz Eliezer's position and I think that everything has to be done to me to live every minute possible. So the law in Israel says that the physician is obligated to treat him unless it causes harm to someone else or it causes harm to the patient himself. So for instance, if a dying patient says, I want fluid, and the physician says, philosophically, I will give you fluid, but in your condition it will kill you. You'll get pulmonary edema because you can't handle it. That's a medical decision, and then you overcome this wish because it's a medical decision. I know for a fact that there are many physicians who abuse this difference, and they say it's a medical decision not to treat you, but in fact they think it's a philosophical decision not to treat. They're afraid to say it, so either they use futility or they use a medical indication. But I'm talking in the true sense. The true sense is that halakhically, if the treatment is detrimental, you don't treat. If because treating him, someone else is being damaged, you don't treat. He has less of a priority. But given all this, that you can treat him, and that is his wish, and you as a physician think it's not indicated, that is not enough of a reason not to treat a patient. Now, I said it in several locations here, the same way as there is a patient's autonomy, there is a physician's autonomy. And if you as a physician think it's futile from your own definition, without going now into the debate whether it's futile or not, you have the right not to treat this patient, not to give him what he wishes. But there has to be someone who will give him his wishes. That's the whole principle of autonomy. Why do you use autonomy when it goes well with your thinking, but you don't use autonomy when it's opposing your thinking? Most physicians think that in a certain situation, treatment is futile and you shouldn't give it. And if the patient says, I don't want to be treated, you say, I respect his autonomy. But if this patient says, I want to be treated, and you think it's wrong, all of a sudden, his autonomy is gone. Why? There's no reason to do it. So I think it has to be symmetric if you talk about autonomy from an ethical point of view. From a halakhic point of view, it certainly is symmetric. So there's no reason not to treat. Now, if someone, the issue that we come across quite frequently, there's a patient in the ICU on a respirator, and he is dying by definition. Halakhically, as we said, you can't remove the respirator. And now comes someone who needs the bed. What do you do in order to solve the problem? On the one hand, the newcomer has the chance and he needs the bed, and priority-wise, you should give him the bed. On the other hand, you can't remove the respirator from this person. So what we do is put him on the floor with the respirator, knowing that the treatment will be less effective, but still you're not doing an act that hastens death. And therefore you gain both. You gave the bed to whoever deserves it, and you didn't do an act that hastened death, you just gave him less of an optimal treatment, which is okay in this situation, in this particular situation. Now, not always is it possible, and sometimes we run into problems that need specific decision making in this situation. Talking about the general rule, how to approach it. But if, for instance, someone is on dialysis and you don't have any more dialysis machines, and someone who is dying is on dialysis, and someone who has a chance to live needs the dialysis, then you can withhold further treatment from the dying patient because withholding is permissible. So these are nuances within this complicated situation. They are not easy, and it's not one way to solve it, but I'm just saying as a general guideline.
I want to say only three short remarks. First, the subject of priority is a very hard subject. I offer there is next conference we can talk about priority in medicine, which is special. Second remark, in American law, in the landmark Cruza of the U.S. Supreme Court, there was a dispute. The basis of what they call right to die, dignity, death, and so on, is respect the autonomy of the person. I'm point out this point because the minority in Cruza said, no, the criteria must be the best interest of the patient, as I see it, or as the physician see it. Of course, there is a difference. There are many nafkaminas. Third remark, aloha. There is aloha who is agreed by everyone. If a house is destroyed and someone on Shabbat, we know that he has only 5 minutes or 2 minutes to live. We have to lechalel Shabbat, to break the Shabbat and to save him, though we know that he will not mekayem Shabbatot Arbe, he will not live till the end of Shabbat. Why? The Meiri say, maybe in his last minute he will think about Shuvah and this will provide him Olam Haba. 1 minute of Iruei Shuvah. So who knows?
That's a psak by Rav Moshe. It's not some rabbis. I mean, Rav Moshe is someone to account on. And he held that if you remove the respirator for suctioning, and you do it from time to time, then it's a new decision whether to install it back. Most poskim disagree with this psak of Rav Moshe. They hold that this is not making it a periodic treatment, because this is the nature of the continuous treatment. That's how you treat a respirator patient. And therefore, that is not sufficient. We in Israel invented, I'm sure you heard it here and there, a timer on a respirator, which makes it a cyclic treatment, inherently. In other words, you put the patient with a timer on the respirator. The timer is set up for, let's say, 5 days. And after 5 days, you can reassess whether the patient needs the respirator or not. And if you decide that it doesn't need, you let the timer stop the respirator, and then it's a new decision whether to renew it. So that is a more inherent cyclic within the continuous treatment. Many rabbis have agreed, some didn't agree, as usual. There are disputes of positions. We are at a stage of experimenting this particular device. It went through already a few patients and it worked very well without any hazard. It didn't stop at the wrong time. It stopped when it wanted to stop and so on. And hopefully it will come into play. I know that many look at it as a trick, you know, actually it's a continuous treatment and you do a trick and you change the halacha. From a halachic point of view, it's really not bothering at all because you sell your chometz every Pesach and it's a trick. Now we're approaching Shemitah, we sell the whole country to a goy and we eat the produce as if it belongs to the goy, and no one can buy a whole country, obviously. And these are halachic parameters that are acceptable. But I think also from an emotional ethical point of view, it makes a lot of sense, and we got many physicians around the world asking when will it be. They want to implement it, not because of their halachic concerns. And that is that philosophers, lawyers, people who are outside the field of medicine say, why not stop the respirator? It's a simple thing. What's the difference between withholding and withdrawing? Philosophically, it's the same, and do it. But the ones who have to do it, it is a very difficult task to do it, at least initially. People get used to healing and it comes easier later. But all have told us that initially they had great difficulty to do an act knowing that by their act the patient is dying. Although philosophically they thought it's okay, but it's difficult. Now, if you achieve the same goal by the timer and you don't have to do it actively, so from a psychological point of view, it is a great advantage. And if halachically it works, then why not do it? So whoever would agree with it halachically can use it, and that has another advantage. There are many physicians in Israel that are hesitant to put a patient on a respirator because they're afraid that he'll get stuck. But some of the patients, if they would have been put on a respirator, may survive. But since they don't know it, the physicians ahead of time, they're hesitant to do it. If they know that they have a way out, many more people will be treated initially, and then if it doesn't work, there's still a way out. So there are a lot of advantages to this. So you're right that you can turn the continuous treatment of the respirator into a cyclic treatment even by suctioning, but since most poskim don't see it as a real interruption, then the timer is something in this happening.
Yeah. I'm also in touch with the actual oncologist. I'd like to ask you about feeding blood products and simple antibiotics. I'll make this a very short question. I mean, to put patients on hospice, we're not expected to give transfusions, etc. We're not expected to give transfusions. We're not. Right. We certainly don't get blood counts all the time. So I'm wondering if you're talking about blood, you know, the patient's hemorrhaging, as opposed to just not giving blood transfusions. If a patient stops eating, not to put a transfusion to. You make a better definition for us of what you meant by feeding blood and simple antibiotics.
Right. So thank you for the question, because that is really something that we have worked on very carefully. It's not, I can't talk about every detail at length, but responding to your question, blood that is required to give is not in a situation where the disease is causing the fact that the blood is needed. In other words, if someone has a disease that replenishes his blood and he needs continuous transfusions, you don't have to do it. That's part of the dying process. What we are talking is about someone who has an incidental hemorrhage and he needs one pint of blood and that's it, and he'll continue to live. That is what we call a routine treatment, not as part of the dying system. The same is with antibiotics. If you have an overwhelming sepsis and the patient is going to die because of the overwhelming sepsis even earlier than from the leukemia or from the cancer, you don't have to give antibiotics in this situation because this is pertaining to the dying situation. We are talking about someone who has a simple pneumonia within a heart failure situation or a kidney failure situation that he will die in 6 months, and if you won't treat his simple pneumonia now, he will die now. Then you should treat. But if someone is going to die of the sepsis, you don't have to run after every sepsis. The same is with insulin. If someone develops severe diabetes as part of his dying process, you don't have to give him insulin. But if someone was all his life diabetic and he needs the routine amount of insulin and now he has a dying condition unrelated, then you have to give it. So these are some of the differences. Obviously, you're right.
How about feeding?
Now, feeding is a major problem. Feeding is something that has to be done unless there's a medical contraindication. If the reason not to feed is because the person that the surrounding, the patient, the family, the physician, think that he should die, and he dies of hunger rather than of his disease, that is not permissible. So in other words, if someone has an advanced cancer of which he will die in 3 months, and now he doesn't want to eat anymore, and he'll die in 2 weeks of hunger, that is not acceptable at all. But if you will feed him and he will develop all kinds of complications, metabolic and others, then you don't have to feed him because that's a medical condition.
You're saying you would need to put a feeding tube.
What?
You would need to put a feeding tube.
You need to put a feeding tube. Now, what we do, I have children that have neurodegenerative diseases and they are dying eventually in 6 months, in a year or so. We put a feeding tube when they are well. But they are still eating for months. And we keep it. We close it and we keep it. Once he reaches a stage where he can't eat by mouth, he has an opening venue and you feed it. It's easy. It doesn't cause any disturbances. The reason not to do it is only to let him die. That is not sufficient.
The question has to do with within the community. We see many people in Jewish community, various places, using living wills in ways that are not healthily acceptable. People make a wrong decision on antibiotics, we watch another doctor use a wrong antibiotic, it tears apart. When we see people misusing advanced directives, it tears us apart because the consequences are death. What is our responsibility individually to be active within our own community, to speak out, to get involved in individual cases when we hear them? Speak to that, please.
I think that we can do only what we can do. I mean, if the law of the land is that you don't give food and fluid and that's okay, and that is the wish of the person, you can't enforce food to someone that legally is entitled not to eat, right? That's beyond your force. All you can do is if it is someone that you are in touch with, you are his personal physician, you have good contact with him, try to explain to him that from a halakhic point of view, he should do it differently. If he doesn't listen to you, I don't think you have to resign from being a physician and make sure that he gets food. That's beyond what you can do.
I may have missed this. Is there an overlap? Did you define for a goseis versus a geyser and how the difference in the halacha?
Well, a goseis is someone that is going to die immediately. Immediately is defined by some poskim as 2 to 3 days. So that is really end stage of life. The problem is that with our knowledge in medicine, we can't predict the 2 days. Occasionally we can, but in many instances we can't. So therefore we don't relate to Ilchot Goses. But if we would have related to Ilchot Goses, then indeed you shouldn't feed him at that point. You shouldn't monitor him at that point, but you're not allowed to move him at that point. So it's a different category which we hardly use because we don't know how to define it on practical levels. Hayesha'a is a much wider range, and therefore you can define it somewhat better.
I've had a number of patients who had ID drips of facial presses deplete. And the question is, how does Rabbi Steinberg and how does he see the post can treat whether that's a supportive light or continuous or cyclic treatment, and whether or not replacing the facial presses relates to circulation, not the cyclic insulin infusions, make a difference. That's a very common problem.
Right, so I'll tell you a personal anecdote. My father was in a dying situation, and he had the drip, and that was the only thing keeping him still alive. I went to Shlomo to ask what to do. He said, as long as it runs in the bottle, continue. When it finishes in the bottle, don't replace it. So that is when you're talking about someone who is defined as Hayesha, who is suffering, and whom you allow not to extend life. That would be a cyclic treatment like any other cyclic treatment.
Very quick item, Rabbi Steinberg. You had one slide up there with the signatures of the four post-skin. It did not appear in the materials we got. Would it be possible for that to be distributed?
Yeah.
Well, that's
yeah.
A
very simple
question.
Yeah.
Short answer, yes.
Dr. Friedman, their wives, the